listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY.
Musician.
Musician.
Podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin, and joining me for this roundtable edition are Robert, and since Chris is out on tour, I asked Ryan Wines to sit in with us again. How you doing, guys?
Very good.
Great, thanks.
So Ryan, you didn't cause too much trouble last time, so we invited you back.
Yeah, well, we didn't get any big arguments yet, so.
No. That drama always helps a podcast. I mean, we've gotten complaints that there was too much agreeing going on the show and not enough disagreeing.
I don't know about that, Kevin.
Don't make me come over there.
Robert, come on.
So, yesterday was an exciting day. The podcast t-shirts finally arrived.
Woo!
Yeah, I'm sporting one right now.
They're very handsome, yes, let me tell you.
Yes, they are. They're great. And you can have your very own CD Baby podcast t-shirt just by going to cdbaby.com. We'll put a link to them on the podcast website, and we would appreciate your support. And they're very cool looking shirts too, designed by Robert's brother, who designed our podcast logo, and it's a different take on the logo. So
yeah, and they're very soft.
They are. They're very soft, softer than a baby's bottom. So, so we would appreciate you supporting the podcast in that way. So check that out. All right. Well, unless you guys have any other chit chat before we get into things,
let's do it.
We'll jump into some news.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
Music.
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 News.
We all know economic times are hard, so what does that mean for music sales? According to a new NPD tracking study, 75% of consumers say they will spend the same amount or more on digital music downloads as they did in 2008. 65% will spend the same or more on video games, and 60% will spend the same or more on CDs. Even in the face of a down economy, entertainment remains a popular spending category, said Russ Krupnik, poor guy, last name, entertainment industry analyst for NPD. Russ also noted that the importance of buying music lags behind that of videos. Variable pricing has come to iTunes. Billboard is reporting that the recent price increases to $1.29 on some hit tracks at iTunes led to lower sales but slightly higher revenues. Sales figures show that tracks whose prices rose from 99 cents to $1.29 sold 12.5% fewer units than during the previous week. Tracks that stayed at 99 cents sold 10% more than the previous week. On iTunes Top 100, of which half the tracks are sold at $1.29 now, sales dropped 1%, but revenues were up over the previous week, according to iTunes, who declined to provide exact numbers. Guns N' Roses' Chinese Democracy is coming to Rock Band. It took Axl Rose 15 years to bring us Chinese Democracy, but it only took 5 months for the entire album to make its way into the Rock Band video game franchise. Chinese Democracy will be released in its entirety into the Rock Band music store on April 14th, which actually is already there. And gamers will be able to download and play all 13 songs from the record. In an interview with Billboard, Axel mentioned that the game's programmers felt the album's multiple layers and tracks needed extra programming to sound and play correctly. They felt the record, based on the nature and complexity of the depth of the instrumentation, deserved a bit more attention and some more involved elements than they've generally dealt with.
But does that mean it's good or bad?
I don't know. And finally, Facebook is now the number one social network in Europe. We all know Facebook is taking over the social network landscape, so no need to give more numbers on that. So those are the headlines I found interesting or entertaining in the case of Guns N' Roses.
Right.
So to me, the Guns N' Roses thing, it's like when Behind the Music was such a hit TV show, and then they started featuring bands and albums, that it's like, nobody wants to go behind that one.
No, not at all.
You're running out of material. So, but the iTunes pricing thing is interesting because I know a lot of artists are wanting to immediately think, okay, I want to charge $1.29 for my track now, and sales suffered because of it. And,
yeah, don't do it. I especially for an indie artist, if you put a higher price on your album, then you know.
I have to wonder about that too in the current state of the economy. There being less extra spending available for people to spend on these sorts of things. You raise the price, it kind of makes it more of a challenge. And then in the current state of the economy, there's also a talk of potential for deflation.
Yeah.
And so with those sort of things happening, the timing of this certainly seems suspect.
Well, I know a lot of it was apparently stuff that's been going on for years where the labels have been basically demanding that of iTunes. So they say. Who knows? Right. But
it's the labels, and you know, let the labels suffer if that's what they want. You know, iTunes is like, sure, here you can have it. But I think that the mistake would be as a indie artist to be like, oh, that's what I want, because I think that that could hurt an indie artist, whereas it might not make that big of a dent for a major artist. Yeah.
Well, here's a question too: with file sharing still on the rise, apparently, does it make sense to keep raising the price of the digital music?
I mean, it seems counterintuitive
intuitive to me.
Yeah, but for indie artists, I think it is a good thing if you're still at the 99-cent level, and for people selling on CD Baby with the rollout of our new CDBaby.com coming this summer, you will be able to choose between the $69.99, $1.29. Sounds like a Taco Bell menu. But you will be able to choose, and
I'll get the double-double.
Yeah, but I would recommend you keep it at the 99-cent level. That way, you know, you're standing out. If there's two tracks where they like yours or maybe some other artist that's more well-known, they may go, oh, well, let's go for the indie.
Well, artist. Everything at Amazon is 89 cents, right?
I think Amazon is 99. Walmart is 89 cents.
Walmart, yeah. We'll could be wrong. Huh.
Let's not kid ourselves, though. I mean, iTunes is where, you know, the lion's share of people go to download music. And, I mean, even at that, I mean, I think, you know, if artists really want to stay on top of this, they'll, you know, bring more attention to the pricing, you know, with their fans, communicate that, let people be aware of what's going on in the market, let them know that they're keeping their price more reasonable, and maybe even take steps to control your price on your other digital outlets besides iTunes.
We have approached the episode recap portion of the podcast. We're going to discuss my interview from last week, episode number 55, with David Nevue. David built his whole music career just by marketing his music online, and I thought it was a very unique story and lots of good information in what he said and what he's been doing with his music career. So just throw it out there. What was your guys' general reaction?
I was impressed. I mean, it's amazing for someone who's, you know, to hear from someone who's been in it from the beginning, who's been selling online since how long ago?
Since 1995.
1995. He could have invented CD Baby.
Yes. I think we've taken enough takes on this podcast that all three of us have said that at one point. I think we're off the script now, though, so it's all original material from this point out.
So he's truly a pioneer, is I think what you're trying to say. Right. One of the first to really figure out how to sell music online and how to do it well and how to make the connection between growing an audience and selling the music to the audience to the point to where you can actually be sustaining your own self, so you don't need another day job or two or three day jobs. You know, you can actually like be a working musician, right?
Yeah. And Robert and I went and got lunch together, and he was commenting, well, what did he do back in 95 if there weren't, like, you know, social networks and things like that? And I know that when I first discovered David, his ebook that he has, a lot of it talks about back then, you know, optimizing your website for search engines and things like that, which back then, when people were mainly using the web to find information, was how they were finding things. And so you also have to remember that if he was, you know, online selling music in the late 90s, I mean, CD Baby started in 98, so David really could have started CD Baby.
I think actually when you typed in piano back then, his was the only website that came up.
Probably was. And so people, you know, as people started thinking about music online and were starting to find out what people were doing, I'm sure David's site came up a lot. And so it's just interesting to hear how that worked. The thing that I'm more curious about is how he was doing the e-commerce portion of it back then, because people weren't as eager to put their credit card information into a website back then.
Yeah, definitely.
Pre-PayPal. Google
yes.
Carts. Well, you got a lot of feedback online from this one, right?
Yeah. There was a lot of great comments, and it lived up to be what I thought it would. A good portion of people loved this episode. One comment from left on the podcast website page by Martin Blasek. He commented that it was the best podcast since our Jonathan Colton interview, which was way back in like number 9 or...
That was back in 95,
I think. Back in 90. So he said he thought all the good episodes were in the can until now, and wow. No, I appreciate it, Martin, but, you know, there's some good episodes along the way, but I see what he's talking about. Jonathan Colton has been a pioneer as well, and so... I think that's what he was referring to, where someone who's really doing it in a real way. And so a lot of people really loved the episode. Then on the other side, we had a comment from Robert Lee King, who thought David came off as just a salesman who was just trying to sell his book. And he thought it was a little too salesy. And
but he is kind of a salesman, right? I mean... He's selling his music.
Yes, he is. Yes, he is indeed. So, but I knew some people would be skeptical. Anytime you talk about someone who's made a career for themselves using the internet, people always question it. Like, did they really do it by being an artist?
Right.
Did they really do it, you know, or is it they found some other gimmick that made people buy stuff that right. they didn't necessarily
well,
want?
Well, it's not like instant fame. I mean, he's been doing it for over 10 years. You know, I mean, this is the sort of snowball effect of like someone, you know, gaining traction and gaining an audience and building a career for themselves over a long period of time.
Yeah. And last time you were on the podcast with us, Ryan, I mentioned or alluded to this interview, and I think it goes in along with what you were talking about with frequency. David in his interview said, you know, it's built up such a point that, you know, he's got 150 ways that people can find his music, meaning each of his tracks that he now has available. And, you know, the final piece of the puzzle that kind of made it all kind of put together the whole story and made me want to get him on the podcast was that he wrote a blog about how, you know, during this recession, he expected to see his sales drop. But just recently he had his highest weekly payout for digital downloads because he uses CD Baby for his digital distribution and then he sells CDs himself through his own website. And he said he normally gets, you know, on a monthly average about 1,500 to 2,000 for the whole month for digital downloads. But this one week he got over 2,000. And then, you know, the week after that, it even went up again.
Wow.
And so to him, he had to stop and think, okay, why is this the case that all these my sales are going up? And he really looked at it and saw that it's because I have this vast catalog, a lot of the old songs, when people discover my new music, the old songs sell as well. And the more I have available, the more options there are for people to buy. So
it is accumulative.
Yeah, and it's sort of the whole long tail thing.
So. Yeah, you know, I mean, when you find an artist, when I find an artist that I really fall in love with, I want it all. On all their albums.
You've won it all.
I do.
Well, I know when I first heard David's story, I was particularly set back. I was like, wow. You know, he said he did $2,100 in sales in 1 week for digital sales. And initially when I hear things like that, I think like many people, you know, it sounds too good to be true. But then when you take time, listen to the podcast and hear his story, you realize that there is no get rich quick option. There is no, you know, silver bullet or one thing you can do and all of a sudden you can be like David Nevue. What his story is, you know, lots and lots of hard work. I mean, he's taken the time, to your point, Robert, about like over 10 years, you know, working away, you know, slow and steady wins the race. And he's been very thoughtful, I think, of the very basics of what it takes for an independent artist to succeed.
Yeah.
And that's being very thoughtful about your fan base. He spoke at great length about listening to his fans, about having a focus group or taking a group of fans out to pizza, asking them what they think, asking them what they want, And then not only that, but having a wide variety, you know, to speak to the art of frequency, have a wide variety of music available and to constantly be putting out new music. And when you look, take a step back and look at his whole story and the way he does it and the way he brings people along, it's not only having a huge catalog, which it sounds like in his strategy has worked, but it's also building this tribe of people. And he spoke, you know, about his strategy of how he's built fans, which I think is very fascinating. But not only does he have a huge catalog, but it sounds like he's got a huge email and contact list of people he's drawing to. And I think when you can connect those two things and then, you know, do some additional tactics like packaging and being at certain places on the web and doing some good SEO strategy, then over a amount of time, if you work really, 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 really hard, you know, you have a chance to succeed as he has.
You know, I think that's one thing that, you know, he talked about, that the first album he made and he put it online and, you know, it took a long time to actually see really anything worthwhile. And then he took the money from the sales he had. And, you know, he built his whole career basically online, but he did play in his local community. He's right. Never toured, though, until recent years when the demand built up. But so he was just doing it all on what he could do on the internet and locally. And that's why, you know, when I hear someone like this, I know a lot of our listeners, that's what they're trying to do. They know they've got jobs or they just don't have the means to tour, but they can play in their community, their city, their town, and can market online. And I think with David, he was just very intentional with that. I think figuring out who his audience was key too. You know, he talks about, you know, he plays solo piano. And so he spent a lot of time trying to find out where people that are looking for that kind of music would be, and really narrow in who they are. And you know, even back before social networks existed, he was on forums and
he was social networking.
Yeah, he was social networking. It just wasn't in the form that it is today.
Right.
And he even mentioned he wasn't just going, hey, buy my album. You know, he was building relationships with people. And I think that's probably something that has been a big, you know, factor that we didn't talk about much. But I can tell he's a nice guy. I'm sure he's been very intentional with listening to people and building real authentic relationships, as opposed to what a lot of artists do is they just send blasts to people, buy my album, and people just don't take notice for that. And so you've got somebody who's been able to do that well with a good size catalog over years, just building and building, building his email list and building it and doing that well. So when he does release an album, like he said, now when he releases a new album, he'll sell pretty much 2,000 copies right out of the gate and totally recoup. And so he's set. And I think there was some numbers that he mentioned. I thought I had recorded it, but when I listened to the podcast again, it's not in there. But I think he was saying that total, he was making a little over 100,000 a year.
Wow.
And he said, but that, you know, I have costs for doing, because shipping and things like that, but it still was well over 50.
He was grossing 100,000.
Right. Yeah, he was grossing 100,000 a year. So, you know, the one-time payout that he said that was, you know, $2,000, that was just digital sales. CD sales he does through his website. And he talked about when Christmas approaches, it just gets almost unbearable for him to even handle and just fulfilling orders. And so that makes him a ton of money. And then some other things he did that I thought was very unique, like making all his songs available in sheet music and selling the PDFs.
Does he use CD Baby for physical merchandise shipping?
No, he does that all himself.
Wow.
And I can understand him, you know, like we've said, he was around way before CD Baby, so he's got it dialed in too for himself. Yeah. So for him, it makes sense. Where I think I mentioned this that on the podcast that for the average artist, I'm hesitant to say, yeah, you should do it that way, because I know artists, they're generally not the most task-oriented people.
That's why they need people like me, right?
Yeah, that's why they need Ryan to keep hitting them with the whip. Get to work.
Well, I think what you're saying, though, is like it's not rocket science to figure out how to fulfill orders, you know, if you're doing a small amount. And the biggest problem you can have is that it gets so overwhelming because there's so many orders that you can't handle it anymore. And then you hand it over to someone like CD Baby who, you know, can do it without even thinking twice about it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, a lot of times, too, is that like if you actually, I mean, if you're not doing it extremely efficiently, there's so many costs involved that you could end up losing more money doing it yourself than you would using a fulfillment company like CD Baby.
Yeah. And, you know, David, he's doing such a high volume that he's probably getting bulk discounts like companies do.
Right.
Where, yeah, if you're just sending out a couple CDs a month, you're going to end up paying in time and your resources far more than every, CD Baby's
all cuts. The gas going back and forth to the post office.
So, you know, for him, he's done it online for so long, it's kind of reached this critical mass of where, it makes total sense for him to do it. But like you were saying, it's a lot of work, Ryan, you were saying. And an artist, you know, when they hear about someone like this and they get skeptical, I think a lot of it is just they just don't want to work for it.
If I can, just for a moment, bring it back to the idea that he has, I think, over 150 songs available for his fans to buy, and it kind of speaks back to the frequency component. I know that there are listeners out there who are thinking, stop, wait a minute, 150 songs is a lot of songs, and if you're just talking about frequency, what about quality? And I know that I got some response to our last discussion about, hey, what about quality? Are you just putting music out for the sake of putting it out? Or are you really stopping and think about good songs? And, you know, a few bands have been able to keep that level of frequency really high while keeping the quality really high. I think the best case study ever is probably the Beatles. I think to that point, I think there's a lot of consideration that needs to go into, are you putting out music just for the sake of putting out a lot of music, or is there quality? And I think it goes without saying, there has to be an element of quality. You have to hold a high standard and a high bar for what you're putting out. Now, if you're, another conversation we had about frequency was about putting out a demo once in a while to bring your fans along and get kind of show them the behind the curtain look at what you're doing. And that's different. You know, of course that needs to have some quality too, but that's kind of a different aspect. But, you know, if you're going to be putting out a high volume of music, you certainly have to be able to focus on quality. And I think to David's unique position is he's creating enough income and he's doing this full time that he can do this to a degree where it's high attention to quality, and he knows his fans. And so, you know, he's able to do it right.
One of the things I wanted to highlight was his, you know, he had a long-term plan, where I think so many artists I talk to, it's that they either have, it seems like they have the mindset that this is it, you know, I've recorded these 10 songs, this is our make or break moment. Not that I'm an artist, I hope to be able to work into a full-time career, and it's going to take time, and it's going to take multiple albums.
And this first album might not sell right out the door, but it's something I can build upon, you know. And you know, when people do buy your second album because it's gotten a little bit of publicity, it's, you know, there's a good chance they're going to buy your first one too.
Yeah, and it's not only something to build on financially and fan base-wise, but also artistically as well.
Yeah.
And
and to David's point, I mean, he took a lot of time during those, you know, those 10 years to really get to know his fan base. And he spoke about getting to know them and getting to know what other music they like that is in his ballpark. And so he was able to find out their musical tastes and their likes. And I think he said, you know, if they're, you know, it over here in a certain community or in a certain place online or a certain website, then he would go there. He would seek them out. He would learn about them. He would research them. And then he would try to meet them where they're at. Because I think if we know music, you know, connoisseurs very well, we know that it's not very likely that they're going to stick to one musician only, or even one genre. So right. So knowing that, we know that everyone who's a music fan or is buying music, you look at iTunes or CD Baby, you know that everybody there is there for probably multiple purchases. They want to be a fan of multiple people and artists. And so if you know that, I mean, what a fertile ground it is to go out there if you're putting out good quality music and target these people. That's one of the things, you know, in this concept of tribes is when you build a tribe or a fan base, you don't have to start from scratch and build your own. There's other tribes out there that, you know, have mutual fans or mutual tribe members. And so if you know a fan base out there that might have similar characteristics as yours, you know, go find them. You can piggyback with them, or you can compel them to be part of your fan base. And also another fan base. A case study I've heard used before is when Jerry Garcia died and the Grateful Dead ended. There was this huge tribe of thousands of people, if not millions of people,
right,
Just sitting there, left, without a leader, right?
Literally sitting there.
Yeah, sitting there.
Probably somewhere outside of San Francisco.
Smoking. Yeah. The big cloud of smoke over their
sitting
heads.
Sitting in some field going, they're not playing today.
Yeah. Festival. But they're sitting there, and it was a great opportunity for a band like Fish or a band like Mo to step right in and say, hey, we do something that's kind of like that, and if you like Grateful Dead, you might like us. And sure enough, that fan base, you know, was able to go, you know, over to another artist or another sound and follow that. I think another person who's done it well, and I think it's fair to say, is Justin Timberlake. If you look at the way he's positioned himself and the way that he markets himself, oftentimes you'll see him associating himself with Michael Jackson. I think he's even done some live appearances with Michael Jackson. He's put on the glove and wears the hat and dances. And it's genius because he's looking, saying, well, here's an artist that kind of stopped and has gone away who had a huge fan base and a huge tribe following him.
Yeah.
So you know what? I'm going to make an effort, maybe not a complete effort, but a reasonable effort to appeal to that tribe who needs a new leader and a fan base who needs somebody else to latch onto or to follow or to get excited about.
Yeah.
And I think that, in a nutshell, is kind of what David was talking about when he's like, when he explained that he goes to other artists who might have appeal to a similar fan base, mm-hmm. and we'll learn about his fans and we'll go after them.
Well, I think it's important to, you know, when David was talking about talking to the fans and, you know, finding out why they like your music, I think that's why that conversation is important, because you might find out that all these people are connecting on your music for this reason over here that you had no idea about and you haven't even thought of, that just was a natural thing. And if you don't have that conversation, you'll never know that, and you'll just be maybe spinning your wheels trying to promote it over here doing something else. You know, so it's just finding out why people are buying your music or interested in you in the first place.
I'm sure that Queen is still baffled that so many people buy their albums based on hearing We Will Rock You at sports games.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, sometimes it's, you know, every artist thinks they're buying my albums because I'm the greatest artist that ever lived. And that's not the case. One last thing before we get to the calls on the topic of sheet music that David was doing. Merchandising has always been a big part of how David has approached his website, merchandising well, packaging things, bundles. And, you know, if we're going to have a conversation about having a music career and selling stuff in order to, you know, music and other things, it is about, you know, creating products. The music itself is a product. A lot of people sometimes have a problem with that. And if you have a problem with that, you know, that's fine. Just play your music in your room and enjoy it, you know, in your bedroom at home or your house. But if you want to make a living making music, you got to think about things along that lines. And I thought that the way he was creating PDFs, which are dirt cheap to make, for the amount of return he was getting, was just a great idea.
I think they're free to make.
Well, he doesn't write music, so he had to pay someone to transcribe it.
Oh,
so.
Gotcha.
But that was one of the gold nuggets of that conversation that I took out of it, was that he's creating this thing as a one-time fixed cost of making this PDF, and then it exists digitally. And so distribution of it and hosting it and giving it away and passing it on is pretty much free, right?
Yeah.
And so once you do it once, it's free. You don't have to pay, let's say, iTunes or CD Baby a percentage. He can sell it from his site. And I think part of the conversation was about guitar tabs. I mean, how many guitar tab, you know, sites have you seen out there? And of course, there's a million. I mean, why not take a little bit of time and a very minimal cost and create that, put it on your website, and sell it for a couple bucks?
Chris, who is normally on the podcast, we were talking about this after the interview, and I said, Chris, this is what you need to do. So everyone who's listening now, here's your free tip. The first person to execute this and send it to me will get a free podcast t-shirt.
Brilliant.
Now we can give those out now. This is what I told him to do. I said, you know, part of what something like a PDF is replacing is the album. You know, a lot of people releasing digitally or not putting as much time into the packaging of the CD. But with this, you have unlimited space and you can use it well. And I told him, you know, he should chart out his songs. He can do it, so he can do it in like a cool handwritten way. Chart it out. And there's like some chord charts, like the melody line written out, handwritten the lyrics, and then include some photos and some stories about the recording and writing of that song that go along with it. You package that all together, you know, and if there's a solo, maybe get that tablatured out. It's something every fan would want, someone who's learning how to play music.
Okay, I just had a brainstorm. This is Robert Bolton original. Along with this wonderful idea that Kevin has just provided you for free.
That's right.
I will include, for no additional charge, this idea, which is to include a desktop background.
That people can put on their,
if you got a really cool picture that's, you know, set it a good resolution, it's, you know, free advertising if it looks cool, and they can set it as their desktop background for their computer. Every time they look at their computer or someone comes over, they see you or your band. Great advertising.
Hey, while we're giving it all away.
Yeah, that's right.
Why don't we go
ahead? Are we getting some steak knives that can cut my shoes in half?
Why don't we go ahead and include a free song that you can't get anywhere else?
There you go.
There's your package. And you did hear David talk about packaging. I mean, mm-hmm. package your stuff up. Well, part of this, you know, is putting your music out there in a compelling way, marketing yourself, positioning yourself, promoting yourself in a way that is going to be compelling to your fans. And there are so many artists out there in the world. I mean, so many musicians. And I will tell you that most musicians, more than anyone else, more than your average Joe, are fans of other musicians and are fans of music. So now you know that you have a built-in portion of your fan base that are going to want the guitar tabs or are going to want the sheet music because they're going to want to learn how to play a song or two. And, I mean, it's fertile ground. It doesn't cost you hardly anything. Why not do it?
Well, speaking of the sheet music thing, one of our listeners, Cheryl, heard our podcast and got all excited because she does transcribing for artists. So she left a message in the comment section. So if you're interested in finding out more what all that involves, her business is called Copycat Music. So if you go to the comment section for episode number 55, her info is there, and she does listen to the podcast. So fellow CD Baby podcast listener. So check it out. She may be able to help you out. Let's get into some phone calls.
Hey, Kevin. Hi, this is Mick from Treetop Tribe. I just listened to your Finding Frequency roundtable with Ryan and Chris, and I really enjoyed it. It's something great to do while I'm stringing the guitar, and gives me something to do during that process, and I really enjoyed it and learned some stuff from it. One of the things that came up for me was talking about demos, using demos. One thing that we've done lately is we've brought a demo of three songs off the album that hasn't been finished yet, and we've been trying to raise some money, and one of the ways we did it is taking our demo, making a, you know, real good quality demo. One of the guys in the band can do it on his computer pretty well. And even does a little bit of a press on them, I guess he can do with his computer to put a little graphic on it, make it a real nice looking demo. And we've been asking people if they would like to make a donation really towards us getting the record done, that we would give them a really high quality demo. And we have been raising some money that way. At the live shows, and so that I hadn't heard that mentioned, and I don't know if that would be considered to be an insane idea for whatever reason, but it seems to be working for us, and I just wanted to throw that in. So, and again, keep up, guys. I really appreciate the podcast. This is the fourth one I've listened to, and I've learned something from every one of them, and it also kind of focuses me that even though the times are so, you know, radically changing and all that with this industry, that maybe in a way it gives kind of the beginners like us a better chance, because maybe we're coming in at a time when we're gonna learn what the new paradigm is, and maybe jump in with that, and maybe that can help us have some success. So anyway, thanks again, Kevin. Take care.
Hello, I'm calling about a comment about over 50-year-olds that you guys had on your podcast number 52. About the over 50 guys. Since I just turned 50, I think that's kind of an insult. We're a big music buying contingent that you have to deal with. So to discount over 50s as can't hear and close to death, I take personal affront at that. I don't like that. So I just wanted to let you guys know. Bye.
Hi, Kevin, and Chris and Robert and everybody. Love the CD Baby DIY Musicians podcast. just listened to the interview with David Neveu, I believe his name is pronounced, and he has some great tips, and he's applying those and seems to be having a great career going. And we all should be so lucky that we can make a full-time living doing what we're doing. There's a cynical part of me, though, that wonders how much his demand for house concerts and his sales is fueled by the Christian community. He let it slip that a lot of his shows are at churches, and the big part of his audience is the faith-based community. And my experience with the people who buy music for that, fans of music like, I believe his name's Robert L. Smith or something like that, who's a huge Christian artist. Some Christian acquaintances of mine turned me on to his stuff, and I listened, and I just did not see the musicality to his stuff. It just bored me and was crappy. And from what I've heard of this guy's stuff, it's great music, and I enjoy it, the clips I heard, much more than I enjoy Robert W. Smith's music. But there is, again, a cynical part of me that wonders some of the success that he's having out there. I wish we all get that success, but it's got to be driven by the Christian community. That's my cynical thought. I'm going to check out the website and listen to his music and see what his underlying market is, but that's my immediate comment that I just had to leave for you. Thanks, guys. You do a great job. Take care.
All right. Those are the calls. And the last call, I don't think they intended for me to play that on the air, but they didn't use their name, so what's the harm? But the artist he was talking about was, I believe, Michael W. Smith. And yes, I would agree that that's maybe not the height of musicality, but I don't see how that becomes a conspiracy theory that anyone who plays at a church suddenly is no longer valid. That just made no sense.
Well, so. I mean, I don't think that that's what he's saying. He's saying that, like, there's like a market, you know, there's a Christian market for music that's, like, I think a pretty powerful force. And if you tap into that, I mean, maybe to other artists who aren't a part of that market, it feels a little bit unfair that they don't get to tap into that resource or whatever. But there's lots of markets out there.
Yeah,
not just
well,
the
that's
Christian
the thing.
One.
That's the thing. You just stereotype. But his whole basis was he didn't like this one artist. That's like me saying, I don't like John Tesh. So anyone who...
Hey, what do you have against John Tesh?
So anyone who's... Any person of any group that has ever even listened to a John Tesh record is no longer valid as far as their opinions of their music and stuff. So, I mean, right. it was a lot of stereotyping, and it seemed like he had another agenda in there than just, you know... And I knew people would be skeptical, but I followed David's stuff for years, and he's done it by just doing the work and putting out good albums. I mean, that's key. And he
quality
does know
important.
His market. And I think, you know, having been in the Christian market myself, one thing that I thought that the Christian market did far better than a lot of artists even consider is identifying who their market is and really catering and speaking to that market. And I think the country market industry does a good job of that as well. And I think a lot of people just in the general music scene that aren't in a smaller genre group like jazz or blues, but people that just kind of feel like they're in pop music, they don't do a very good job of identifying their market. And so I can see why someone on the outside might think, huh, there must be some sort of inside conspiracy theory where they all have to buy his album to be a Christian or something, but no conspiracies. But
to the first caller who talked about putting some demos up to raise some funds for their album, I find that to be a very fascinating idea and strategy. And I haven't quite figured out, you know, an ideal way of putting that together. But I think he's onto something in this new economy of the independent artist. I had a little shameless self-promotion, but I posted a little looking like thought paper called The Manifesto on my Pet Marmoset blog about a week ago. And I got a comment from an artist, her name's Shannon Curtis. I think she might be a CD Baby artist.
Yes, I've placed her in some MTV shows.
Yeah, she's wonderful. She used to actually play in a band several years ago called Paradigm that I actually caught at a small room here in town once. And outstanding artist. I mean, really, really compelling to see in person. But what she did is, and you can read her story. I think if you Google Shannon Curtis, you'll find out what she did. But in a nutshell, she needed some funds to go into the studio and work with a certain producer that she wanted to work with in a certain studio. I think it was in Nashville. And she reached out to her fan base. She let her fans know what was going on. She brought them along in the process. She told her story and put herself out there. And people responded. I mean, people wanted to be part of the process. People, common mantra you'll hear me say a lot is fans want to participate. They want to play a role in what you're doing. They want to believe in you. And when you give them opportunities to play a role and to participate, you give them an opportunity to be a part of the process, you'll be amazed at what happens. And what happened for her was she raised a considerable amount of the funds, if not all the funds that she needed, to go into the studio and record this album. And she did something special, I think, with those that contributed, sent them a special copy with a special note and things like that. But it's a great story. And so to that caller's point, you know, I think he's on to something when you say, hey, I'm going to put out some demos and ask people like, hey, I'm trying to work on this record. Here's the first part of what we're working on. You know, help us get to the end. And yeah. I think it's fascinating.
Well, a similar story that my friend told me just happened to him last week, which I thought was brilliant. He gets a knock on his door. He opens the door, and it's like these 19-year-old, 18-year-old kids, you know, look like rocker kids. And they said, hey, man, we're a band in the neighborhood, and we're just going door-to-door asking people if they'd help support us so we can record our album. We have a demo here. And they were selling for $5. And
awesome.
Of course he gave them $5. He's a musician. He actually teaches at a couple colleges here in town. So he's like, of course I'm going to support you. And he's like, are you guys the band that I hear rehearsing every day?
Yeah,
because he
great.
Just hears some band in the neighborhood playing. And I thought it was so brilliant because, you know, that is the real world social networking. And it not only with all the online focus, we tend to forget about the real networks of people that were involved in our neighborhood, you know, and just, you know, work. And but the thing that I thought was great about it being in their neighborhood is that, you know, there's the context, the perfect context of people hear them practicing, whether they like it or not. And so when they knock on the door saying, hey, we've got this little demo and we're trying to make enough to get an album, people are like, yeah, we'll help you out. And to the second caller, I think he's referring to, we had some statistic where people over 50, the amount of people buying, it drops dramatically.
Right.
And the people with teens, the new statistics where we had said in the past teens had been one of the hottest music buying groups are now one of the lowest. And so that was just the bookends that they put on it. And I think one of you two, Chris, made some derogatory comments about old people as a joke.
Yes. I mean, you know, I don't remember exactly, but I think that we were just talking about that demographic being, you know, people that don't buy music as much because of, you know, whatever. I mean, not people who are 50 necessarily, but maybe people who are 80, you know, or 90.
But the statistics were that it drops off dramatically after 50. And that's all we were commenting on. We weren't saying anything that we don't like old people.
Well, the statistics show it drops off unless you are Neil Diamond or Jimmy Buffett, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Oh, no. Here we go again.
There they come.
That was Robert that said that, by the way.
The calls are coming. But so we don't have a problem with old people. My parents are old people and I love them, so.
You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.